Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out at noon every Tuesday here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Peter Oakes versus the Banksters. To be specific, Royal Bank of Scotland. And former Roger Cook reporter John Dantzig talks about asylum seekers and the migrant crisis. Plus, Sabine McNeil talks about CERN. Dialect's produced by volunteers, so if you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen's Square on 0117 989 7733. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But we start this week with Sabine McNeil. Normally she talks to us about various things to do with the VI paedophile scandal. She had to escape to Germany for a couple of months because she was being pursued by police in London for helping, at least apparently, some of the victims of the paedophiles. But anyway, she's back in Britain now, and for a change, I decided to talk to her about CERN, that is the particle accelerator, which is in between France and Switzerland, which we all know as apparently the place where the God particle is found. And also, it's a particle accelerator. What is it actually really all about? Because Sabine worked there as a computer networker, I asked her.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm joined on the line now from Germany by Sabine McNeil. But Sabine, you're not here to talk about the usual, which is to do with the various child sexual abuse scandals. You're here to talk about CERN. Tell us, what is CERN and why are we talking about it this week?
Well, first of all, Tony, I'm sorry to disappoint you. I am back in London, and that's where I don't have my mobile phone because I was arrested and the police confiscated my phones. But I was the last weekend I spent in Germany, I was at a meeting where CERN was on the agenda because Germans like to philosophize. And so they love to create their worldviews from science. And there was a talk about it. And a very interesting guy had put something very neatly together in PowerPoints. And I could tell him exactly those points that I can sort out where... Because he had claimed that mathematically it was decided that the world has 12 dimensions. Well, at CERN, where I used to work and diagnose software, one would talk about string theory, which is supposed to have 17 dimensions. And now there's this big threat that the dimensional portal is going to open and destroy the world.
Well, look, before you carry on, I want to say something a little bit about another big European project, which is down in Culham Laboratory here in Oxfordshire. And that is Joint European Torus. Now, this is the fusion. Am I right? I think it's the fusion project where they have a giant donut. And I knew a physicist that worked there. She gave me a tour of the building and she explained to me, well, the very first day they ever actually got the experiment going, that's what they called this donut, the experiment. The calculations told them that there was never going to be any kind of possibility of it producing cheap nuclear energy. And so the rest of the time, that entire project, even though it comes under the European civil energy funds, is actually only being used by the military. So what's the story at CERN?
Well, the CERN is the European Centre for Nuclear Research, and I got my first job there in 1966 as the diagnostician of software. So I helped physicists find their mistakes in their computer programs. Recently, I was invited as the only woman to a meeting of 50 years of computing at CERN, and the boss of my then boss told the story how he came across me at the time, which was very amusing because he had also told everybody how hard it was to convince physicists of the value of computing. And that's critical because I also read recently a book called Pythagoras' Trousers by a woman who traced back the monopoly that physicists have liked to take upon themselves to define the worldview based on their physics. Well, it so happens that I came across a quotation by Einstein where he basically is saying that mathematics doesn't describe reality where it is proven and where it does, where it doesn't, otherwise it doesn't describe reality. In other words, there's a gap between physics and mathematics. Very fundamental, according to Einstein. And it so happens, who am I to say, but it's very true. I've, since 1997, I have been analyzing and working scientifically to try to understand how come that I had this amazing breakthrough in terms of mathematics, and that meant it, I was either crazy or I was onto something very serious. And in general terms, I can now therefore say that metrology is the missing link between physics and mathematics. And it's precisely the dimensionality that I have used as my yardstick for analysis. And so when the German guy talked about 12 dimensions and physicists talk about 17 parameters in string theory, it boils down to the fact that the physicists at CERN don't rely on mathematically speaking on the timeline and on the number line and on time being the fourth dimension, and they don't distinguish between, if you like, the dimensional quality of various data. And that is true in metrology. It starts by the fact that the basic units in metrology are meter, which is linear, one-dimensional, kilogram, which is three-dimensional, and which is clearly, if you like, something physical, and second, or hour, which is time, and is supposed to be four-dimensional. And every normal human being that can perceive has a hard time perceiving a fourth dimension. So there was a guy called Giordano Bruno who was burnt on the stake in the 16th century who said there is no time, there is only movement. Because if there was no movement, there would be no time. So that's one of the triggers that I had so that I could understand what is lacking. So at CERN, what they are doing today, the same of what they were doing in the 60s. They're creating events, building bigger and stronger machines, but doing more and more of the same, i.e. smashing atoms and into more and more of what I call a particle zoo, now they call it themselves, you know, lots and lots of little articles, and they go into more and more detail, so that they know less and less about, more and more about less and less, but cannot talk to astrophysicists. And that's the key. And the software that I've developed is independent of scale. So you can give it data from microscopes and from telescopes or images, and data that is of very small dimensions or scale and of very large.
So look, is there any room for God in all of this? Because I know, yes. You know, is there?
Yes, because I just read yesterday a nice little definition. God is the word for everything that goes beyond all intellectual levels currently understood. So that's why if physicists presume this godlike position of pretending to understand the world and the universe and how the universe works and use that godlike language, that's exactly what the woman writes in Pythagoras' trousers. That when I got to CERN when I was 22, I thought, oh. Here they understand God because they know about the smallest and they know about the largest, but they don't. And Jack Steinberg, a Nobel Prize winner, who was one of my clients, when I met him recently, he also said, oh, he's into cosmology now. You know, so they space out from the smallest to the largest. They want to create a whole system, but can't because they don't have a whole mathematical model. And everybody talks about math models. And CERN, there used to be 200 theoreticians in one particular wing, and they are, if you like, separate, but they think it up, what needs to be then proven by experiments, so where all of these hardware people come in and build these fabulous machines, and where they play, in quotes, with energy, and in that sense you can say they play God, but they don't understand. I mean, of course, who am I to say they don't understand what they're doing, because they understand it given within their world.
I mean, but is it a waste of money?
In my view, yes. I mean, I remember I was in the car with somebody. I knew all of these guys because they had to come to our inquiry office. I was telling him that, you know, I just have a laptop and that in a way is enough. And I tried to convince lots of people there and mainly Russian physicists actually saw that my software would be useful for them. But we couldn't find a way of bridging this public funding or publicly funded research. and everybody being in on their salary with my outside the box thinking and the, even the it's institutionalized funding, which is very, very different. I mean, the principle is the same there as it is here in the UK, as well as in Berlin. I've been there, done it. I've explored it all. But I just haven't managed. But then I belong to the 12% of women in technology, science and technology, which I consider to be a huge hurdle as well. The technology strategy board here has said, oh, yes, she doesn't explain herself. In other words, they just want it for free, what I've thought up. And that's what that is true for the whole academic world.
That's no good. That's like a robbery. Anyway, how do people follow your work, though? Sabine?
They don't, because I have, I publish a few things, but you see, after my first big insight, I went to a patent agent and he said, you can't patent a theory, you have to produce vendable products. And so ever since I've been developing things. I mean, I started out with what I called the wood bead game as a version of the glass bead game by Hermann Hesse, which I wanted to get an internet game, because I am fundamentally a software person and, if you like, cybernetic type thinker, and i.e. a la Norbert Wiener, who coined the term cybernetics at the time as a system of control. So I'm a system analyst, I'm a system thinker, and the software that has come from that is a prototype with which I've demonstrated three different methods, and which are very fundamental, which are very unique. Everybody wants to know how I'm doing it, and but nobody funds me to do it, but I hope that I'm close to getting it done now.
So, one of the things that always occurs to me is this sort of 2001 Space Odyssey thing. Is technology controlling us, or are we in control of it?
Well, that's a bit too general, in my view. I remember writing ages ago something on a 5-inch floppy disk, the Tower of Computing. I mean, the priests are really the programmers now. They are, if you talk about gods, you know, the programmers are controlling what we're doing before the screen, but they are behind the screens. They are, it is a little bit, there's this poem of the, by Goethe, of the sorcerer's apprentice and the magician's apprentice. This is, people don't quite know anymore. Like with a nuclear bomb, they didn't know what really was to be expected. And people just, physicists or scientists are too happy to try. And technology, it's now, it depends. I mean, I saw a fabulous PowerPoint presentation which was called Shit Happens, and because it is, technology just is going to be faster. The feedback mechanism between our thinking and technology is such that it should be possible that we control the technology, but as long as it's sort of bad science or not as good science as possible, and we'll have problems. I mean, I remember having made an application for funding when I realized that all electromagnetic waves are not in harmony with nature and the universe. But would I get funding? Of course not, because it's outside the box. And there was a Lithuanian professor who offered me a space in his Holloway University. How many applications have I done with him? But it just doesn't work. It's so peculiar. Everybody is in academia is so jealous of each other, and the whole process is so non-ready for genuine innovation. I mean, what I have to offer is a huge quantum leap of creativity, and they just make little step changes.
And let's hope we're still here next week. If CERN is going to destroy the universe or not, what do you think?
Of course it can't, it won't. I mean, it's honestly, it's just more of the same, and it's very peculiar that now people are worried about it when I suppose it's because of Dan Brown and so on, so people are more aware of its existence, and people have been thinking themselves about energy. But unfortunately, what is currently taught in academia and understood in academia is just not, if you like, as up to scratch as it could be. And in fact, it's boiled down to the solid state model that Sir Arthur Hoyle, Fred Hoyle, advocated. That's what I can confirm, that that's true, and that makes a huge difference, rather than the Big Bang theory, which is built on a linear model. And that's, I think, this Big Bang thing from birth to death is something that is too humanly conceived, and we have to think a little bit more cosmically and cosmologically.
Okay, Sabine McNeill, thanks very much for joining us again on Dialect.
Bless you, bye.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, you've heard about the Banksters, the City of London Banksters, and also particularly Royal Bank of Scotland. Royal Bank of Scotland were the employers of a certain chap called Tom Hayes, who's a few weeks ago went down for 14 years as a trader for fixing LIBOR. But of course, his managers knew just what he was doing. He was being headhunted from bank to bank as the greatest LIBOR fixer in the world. And so don't tell me that they weren't part of the conspiracy. Anyway, someone who's been a victim of the banks joins us now.
My name is Peter Oakes. I live in near Sandbach in Cheshire. Many years ago, I had the misfortune of a fallout with the local authority and my local police force. And since then, I have uncovered massive corruption within the United Kingdom. The courts, the court system, the insolvency service, local authorities, police forces are all totally corrupt. And this is all to do with money. If you are a whistleblower or somebody who stands up for his, stands his ground and complains when he's been wrong done by a local authority, they set about to destroy you. And when I say they, I mean the system, the establishment, whoever it is, I am not sure. But the object is to destroy you. And in the travels, I discovered that one of the means is to, bogusly bankrupt you. Because a bankrupt, you're finished and you're rendered penniless. The other thing is, if you write to official bodies, the DTI, the Home Office, the government minister, you just get frustration. You get ridiculous answers that have no bearing on the question you asked. If you write to a government minister, all the mail is intercepted and you get a reply from the Ministerial Correspondence Unit, which is usually a load of rubbish. This frustration is deliberately intended to drive you into an act where you do something stupid, something violent or a disturbance somewhere. This allows them then to have you sectioned under the Mental Health Act. I know of two individuals this has happened to, and it's something you have to go very careful of. The third method of destroying you is the vexatious litigant, Section 42. If you try and take your case to the court, the judge will turn around and say, you are a vexatious litigant, you can no longer bring any action without you get the permission of a judge. And the same thing is, if you're mugged in the street, the police don't want to know, because you're a Section 42. So the three methods of destruction are bankruptcy, sectioned under the Mental Health Act, and Section 42, vexatious litigant. It is absolutely unbelievable, but it is true, and I have all the documentation and victims that can establish this. Now, the area of concern for me at the moment, which can be readily checked, is the Avon and Somerset area, where if people Google Peter Baskerville, Westminster Hall, they will find a Hansard report from last November concerning a farmer called Williams in the Bala area of North Wales. Mr. Williams lost his farm after it being in the family for 100 years, due to financial manipulation and the use of the insolvency service to snatch his property and render the family homeless. Now, this was actually being watched by Avon and Somerset Police, who have over 40 complaints in from the farming community, whereby people have lost their farms through the current recession. The problem being that farmers are asset rich. They have property. But they have cash flow problems. And so they rely on the banks for an overdraft facility. The banks have been removing this overdraft facility and forcing the farmers into taking loans. These loans are loaded with derivatives. They have extremely high interest rates, but worst of all, they have something like a £90,000 get-out clause. So if the farmer wants to surrender the loan and get out, he's still got to find £90,000 to cancel the contract. This was run by a company called Acorn Finance from Bridgewater, I believe, in Somerset. And they use these financial advisors to go around loaning money to people in the farming community with the intentions of drawing them into receivership within 18 months. And this duly happens and they lose all their property. I discovered this in 2001 and I notified a group known as the FSB, the Federation of Small Businesses. I wrote to three chairmen over a period of 7 years. I told them exactly what was going on. But in this case, the people were small businesses, family concerns in all kinds of, outlets. It wasn't just agriculture. The most recent crowd to have been picked on were the small hoteliers in the tourist industry, particularly in Scotland, with RBS and Clydesdale Bank involved, who have had to set aside something in the region of £3 billion to pay compensation. The man who discovered this, if you like, for the public was Richard Tomlinson, who was asked by Vince Cable, who was then the government minister for industry, to investigate allegations and claims that I had made to Vince Cable in the House of Commons in 2008. And of course, Tomlinson was inundated with phone calls when people who had been bankrupted or placed into receivership found out. The amazing thing is the insolvency service is fully aware of this. They actually used the courts to steal people's property. The trustee is involved. In my case, the trustee was a guy called Stephen Ferns in the Newcastle under Lyme office. He was actually told 3 months before a bankruptcy was due to take place exactly what was going to happen. The intended victim and myself attended the clinic of the local MP in Stafford, David Kidney. We told him that they were going to start a proceeding in Stafford County Court with the intentions of stealing this man's property. David Kidney said, this is a matter of the police. Go and see the police. We duly went to Stone Police Station and saw an Inspector Hallam. We explained to him what was going to happen, how he would be presented with a false debt, drawn into the procedure and bankrupt. Inspector Hallam told us, you bring me the crime in Staffordshire and I will deal with it. Well, he didn't. It duly went to court. The man, well, we prevented the bankruptcy. We caused so much trouble that in the end, they annulled the bankruptcy. But it had cost the gentleman concerned over £10,000 in costs and so forth. And lo and behold, halfway through the proceedings, another firm of solicitors came asking for £50,000 on behalf of the HM Revenue and Customs. This was supposedly for landfill tax. This ended up in court. It went through the process of the statutory demand and then a bankruptcy hearing, which suddenly came to an end. It went to the Royal Courts of Justice and the other side didn't turn up. In other words, the Inland Revenue and Customs gave up on the case and walked away. But the amount of harm and distress they caused to that man and his family, well, it broke the family up. They divorced, which is, how can I say, a normal thing with this type of action, is that the stress imposed on the family is staggering, and nobody wants to believe you. They cannot believe that the county courts, the solicitors, the judges, the personnel in the court manager, the police are all involved and nothing is done. And you had a case down in the Gloucester area many years ago, the mad samurai swordsman who chopped an MP's agent up in Cheltenham. The gentleman's name was Robert Ashman. I was actually down in Cheltenham when he first went into the magistrate's court, because I knew what was happening. Robert Ashman had been set up with a duff loan from the National Westminster Bank. He ended up losing his home, his business, and what was his pension. He had a wonderful payoff from the local, from Gloucestershire County Council, whom he had worked for. And this was in the days when they were advising teachers or nurses, firemen, to take out a private pension. In other words, opt out of the government scheme, cash in your pension and join a private one, or take your pension and early redundancy and start a business. This is exactly what Robert Ashman did, and within 12 months it had all gone belly up. He had wrote over 40 letters to his MP, and being fobbed off with nothing but lies and deceit. They, how can I put it? The members of Parliament are fully aware of what is going on, as is my own MP, Edward Timpson, the Children's Minister. And because of what I know and the people I've met, we know that there is child trafficking going on. Children are kidnapped. They are taken in through the adoption process and they get taken into care and they can disappear. And I can guarantee you, I can prove a child out of Stoke-on-Trent, Corrie Raymond Bradley, was kidnapped and shipped back to Australia. But fortunately, we had enough people drawing attention to it. They left the boy alone and he has now grown up. I think he's in the region of 13 years of age. But at the time he was snatched, he was 18 months old. And they even flew his father from Australia, from prison in Australia, who had an apprehended violence order not to approach mother or child. And they actually handed over the baby to this father on a plane at Heathrow and flew them both back to Australia. Now, the parents of this father were what I call good old-fashioned people. They knew their son was a wrong'un. He was a drug dealer. He was violent and actually in prison. He mistreated the girl who had bore the child. They weren't married. But they took the baby under their wing and have raised it as their own, and everything is fine. But that child would have disappeared into the Australian social services system, where he would have been sold. Now, all this might sound absolutely stupid to you, but you can Google, just Google it, and that is the Royal Commission Inquiry, NSW, Police Paedophiles, and it will come up on your screen, and it is over 9 volumes long, and it's a complete, if you like, inquiry of all that was wrong in Australia from 1986 through till 1996. The same thing has been going on in this country and is now opening up with the Rotherham inquiry. And they have had to bring a judge from New Zealand to look into it because ours are totally untrustworthy. Our system and establishment is completely rotten, and they are jockeying for position to keep their names out of it. It's a similar thing to the Jimmy Savile affair, that the only people who have been punished are from the entertainment section. Stuart Hall, Rolf Harris, Gary Glitter, etc. They have been pursued for paedophilia and so forth, but nobody else and from no other profession, where, of course, it is rife. And, if we ever get the truth in this country, I don't know. But that is part of the extent of my knowledge. And of what I am telling you, I can substantiate every word of it. I am not spreading hearsay and rumor. I have had over 25 years of abuse from the authorities, and quite honestly, it is unbelievable. You cannot trust anything. There might be a decent civil servant in the court or in a town hall office, but the moment they try and help you in any way, suddenly down comes the curtains, and you're cast out like a pariah, as though you're the criminal. They criminalize people like myself and our families, where the real culprits are those in authority, from local councillors. Complete and utter waste of time. I wrote to 51 councillors at Crewe and Nantwich Borough. Only one man, a Mr. Clive Roberts, and I'll say his name because he's worth looking up to. Clive Rotherham, by the way, his name was. Clive Rotherham, councillor for Haslington. He turned out to be genuine, and it turns out in life that Clive Rotherham was also ex-SAS 1956 Malaya. In other words, he's a man who's been around the world and he's seen it, and he couldn't believe what I was telling him, but he gave me what support he could. The other 50 councillors stabbed him in the back and didn't want to know. And as I say, I can provide you with a copy of the letter I sent to every one of them. And I can provide you with an email sent out by Rydell Graham, who is the leader of the legal department at Crewe and Nantwich, telling them that they should all ignore this letter, that the things were being investigated by the police and the council's legal department, and they would be resolved. Well, they resolved it by fitting me up in the Northwich Magistrates Court and sticking me in prison for 2 months on perjured testimony. And at a later date, I did a citizen's arrest on a particular individual, and I was charged with assault, and later a restraining order when I arrested her again. And this ended up in Chester Crown Court, where I had 15 witness summonses issued, and every one of those witnesses had their witness summons set aside so they couldn't appear, because had they appeared, it would have unglued the whole blasted mess.
That was Peter Oakes there, a victim of the Royal Bank of Scotland, and very little material about him on the internet, but he's been a victim for many, many years, and let's wish, hope, anyway, that he gets some of his property back.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Well, it's been predicted, actually, for around about 20 years that there may be migrant crises going on, particularly with the problems that there've been in the Middle East and Africa. And also, of course, with difficulty for people finding work and a stable country to live in. Libya is the obvious example of somewhere which was relatively stable and now is effectively run by warlords. And the effect of this, of course, is something that's been going on over the last couple of months, really through July and August, highlighted in Calais. And I'm joined by John Dantzig now. Hi, John. Welcome to Dialect.
Good evening.
John, tell us a bit about yourself as a journalist. Where have you worked in the past?
Well, I've had quite a varied background as both an investigative and campaigning journalist. I used to be a broadcaster and investigative reporter with Roger Cook at the BBC. I've worked on United Nations projects. In my early 20s, I went to Africa and imported with some friends 3 tons of their coffee, and that was the start of the idea for fair trade coffee in this country. So you can see that I've used my journalism to campaign for what I felt were good causes.
Now, not all journalists do that, do they? What is it that drives you to do the campaigning style of journalism?
Well, I guess because I've always tried to have humanitarian values, not wanting to be self-righteous about it. But people have said to me sometimes, John, you can't change the world. And I've said, maybe, but I'll have a good try. I think that you get to a stage where you ask journalism for what, and whether you're just going to report what's there or whether you're going to actually do something that can help maybe change the world for the better if you can.
Before we go on to talk more about the migrant crisis, give us your thoughts about the sorts of pressures that there are on journalists working in Reuters, places like that, the more in the mainstream staff journalists, not necessarily to report both sides of a story.
I think there probably is a pressure under professional journalism and journalists to report. It depends rather what newspapers they are reporting for. I've written recently about some inaccurate reports, for instance, by the Daily Mail, who claimed that hundreds of migrants from Calais were being put up in hotels. Actually, it was 100, and they were all accepted as asylum seekers. So their misinformation actually just alarmed people. They also claimed in the last couple of weeks that 70% of the migrants and refugees in Calais were making it through to Britain. And they got that information, they said, from the chief constable of Kent. But actually, the chief constable of Kent didn't say that. What he actually said was that within 4 months, the migrants in Calais disperse, 70% of them go elsewhere, and we don't know where they go. We don't know whether some of them come to Britain or they go elsewhere in France or try and seek asylum in another country. So that sort of misreporting does inflame people's views about this, and it's not helpful. I think it leads to a society which could easily end up having a sort of hatred for foreigners generally and refugees and asylum seekers in particular.
Do you think any politicians are also in danger of drumming up this xenophobia?
I'm afraid so. I think that the Prime Minister, who's talked about swarms, and I think Mr. Hammond, who said that European standard of living could be jeopardised by the number of migrants and refugees coming to Europe, has actually not helped the situation, and really are not factually correct when you think that okay, it's a large number, 200,000 migrants who have come across to Europe is minuscule compared to the 700 million or so population of Europe. And if they all came and we accepted them, which we won't, obviously, it would really not make a lot of difference if they were dispersed across Europe. But I think that that sort of language actually can be very dangerous to society when, after all, the United Nations has described this as the worst refugee crisis since the Second World War. I believe the worst crisis on record. And our response to that, obviously, is very critical. We are part of a planet that is facing a crisis. And how we help contribute to relieve or exacerbate that crisis will obviously be very important.
Some have compared the scale of the movement of migrants to the hundreds of thousands of people that were shipped across the Atlantic to colonise the United States. Obviously, the situation is very different, and some people were a little bit more, shall we say, voluntary going across the Atlantic. But what is it that causes these giant migrant crises, this one specifically?
Well, there's no doubt that this crisis has been brought about by war and violence and terrorism. And those who say that most of these people are economic migrants are really doing a disservice both to the truth and also to the people who are risking their lives, people and children risking their lives to escape horrible danger and violence and the threat of violence in some of the most war-torn countries in the world. I mean, 62% of those who reached Europe by boat this year were from Syria, Eritrea, and Afghanistan, according to the United Nations, a source that I mostly do trust. And these are the countries that are torn apart by war and dictatorial oppression and religious extremism. And their citizens, when they arrive from those countries, are almost always accepted as asylum seekers with a right to refuge in Europe. We should not be demeaning these people by describing them in the wrong way.
What would you say to those, John, that maybe know somebody or themselves have been made redundant, and they can see that people who are prepared to take much less pay, worse conditions, are taking jobs in Britain?
Well, I'm afraid you've fallen into the trap there of comparing two different types of migrants. Asylum seekers, I suppose, are a category of migrant, but asylum seekers are not generally allowed to work in this country. They only get the minuscule amount of benefits. They're not entitled to normal benefits. They get around £36 a week to subsist on, and they're mostly poverty-stricken. And the small numbers, I mean, for instance, the few thousand in Cali are only about between 1% and 2% of the total number of migrants and refugees who've sought refuge in Europe. So it's just, by comparison, a small number have gone to Cali. And if we took them all in, and I'm not suggesting we should take them all in, but if we took them all in, it wouldn't make any difference to our standard of living. But there's another thing here as well. It's rather sad that poorer people and unemployed people in this country should regard asylum seekers and refugees as a threat to them. We shouldn't be falling into the trap that sometimes politicians enable us to do of being divided and ruled. You know, both sets of people need support. We shouldn't say either or. If someone goes into hospital, or people go into hospital, we don't say, oh, they're being looked after by the NHS, so people who are unemployed will get less. We shouldn't be thinking that way. We are one of the richest countries in the world, and Europe is the richest continent in the world. And if we can't help, then heaven help the planet.
What about big companies, big corporations? Don't they actually stand to gain by having a nice, plentiful supply of cheap labour coming into Britain?
Well, again, you're talking about people working, and asylum seekers generally are not allowed to work. But generally, if you're talking about migrants generally, then you know, modern societies, modern countries have succeeded by migration. We generally are richer by having people come here from other countries. And British people have also benefited from going abroad. If you look at, for instance, European EU migration, which is castigated in the media and by some of our politicians, there are about the same number of British people who have moved to other parts of Europe as European citizens who've come to live and work in Great Britain. So if all Britons in the rest of Europe came home, and the Europeans from the other parts of Europe living here went home, the population of this country would be about the same as it is now. You don't often see that in our media. But these are the sorts of facts that I hope can come out, and people can then maybe adjust their opinions accordingly.
Is there any kind of solution to this that you think maybe we would see the situation at Calais relieved, and possibly those people who are there now trying to get to Britain find a decent home?
Well, I think that as a continent, as a country, we should be doing more. A very small number by comparison try to get to Europe. The vast majority, about 80% of refugees, are accommodated by the poorer countries of the world, the developing countries. Lebanon, for example, houses 1.2 million Syrian refugees, and they've only got a total population of 4.5 million. So you can imagine the impact it has on them. But you know, we have only got a few tens of thousands of refugees living in this country, which I don't think has any impact really on our population and standard of living. We should be doing more. And I remember from stories I've written that in the 1930s we had children coming here on the kinder transport, mostly Jewish refugee children who were escaping certain death by the Nazi regime. And before the war started, some thousands of children were allowed to get a train unaccompanied because the Nazi regime wouldn't allow them to come with adults. And they arrived in this country, and each one had to be sponsored to the tune of £50, which in the late 1930s was a lot of money. And ordinary families took them in. And I just wonder where that sort of traditional British value is at the moment. I think that I'm sure that there were people in the 1930s who decried refugees coming here. But then when I'm reminded of that story of the kinder transport and the children coming here unaccompanied and being looked after, and when I look at the newspapers today about the children coming here who are from war-torn countries who've had to leave their parents behind, it doesn't seem to be the same amount of empathy. And I think we should reconsider and look at ourselves about that. You can go and see my work on my profile website, which is at eyesears.com, eyesears.com.
Keep your eyes and ears open. Thanks very much, John Dantzig, for joining us on Dialect today.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Well, fascinating interview there with John Dantzig, who used to work with Roger Cook on the Cook Report many years ago at the BBC. But actually, the Cook Report, I think, was when Roger was working at ITV. So John worked with him before that when he was at the BBC, because BBC Television refused to have an investigative programme on the television with Roger Cook. So he went to ITV Central Television instead. Anyway, on the subject of migrants and asylum seekers, Angela Balassi joins me now to discuss some reports in our local press round here about the increase in race crime. Now, what is the increase, Angela?
Yes, this is from a Freedom of Information Act reported in the Bristol Post that found that Bristol, parts of North Somerset and South Gloucestershire had seen an increase in race crime for the first time in 3 years. So in 2010, there were 1,130 reported. This went down in 2012 to 885, but it's now up again. Last year, 1,103. And this year already, there have been 553 reported.
Now, this is a worrying trend, obviously. One of the typical divide and rule tactics of many of our leaders in different parts of the world, particularly here in the West, is this whole divide and rule strategy where you start to turn a class war, where you've got massive race inequality, people with very, very little money to survive, into a race war, so that you get people of different races who are all poor fighting each other. Then that kind of takes people's attention away from the ruling classes, the rich, who are doing very well out of all this. So why, I mean, that's just my take on all this, but what is the Western Daily Press and the other press saying about why there's this increase in racially motivated crime round here?
Yes, well, Alex Rakes, who's the Strategic Director for Stand Against Racism and Inequality, says that it's due to various factors. Firstly, though, I suppose there's positive factors, as in it's an increase in reporting and recording. However, they said with their case notes, they found that people are facing more hostility, and they believe this is because of more xenophobic stories in the media, and also terms used by politicians, such as Cameron, referring to the migrants in Calais trying to reach Britain as a swarm. Also, they attribute it to far-right groups, such as the BNP and the English Defence League. The police put it down to an increase in reporting, saying that people are more confident to come forward, and they said they have a dedicated lighthouse team to deal with such matters and are encouraging people to come forward.
Well, I suppose this sort of thing is bound to happen in a city like Bristol, which has got such a very large ethnic minority population. In fact, I remember reading, this is a few years ago now, but I remember reading that Bristol was actually represented probably better than almost any other city in Britain with other parts of the world, which is one of the things I love about community radio, is that we're able to bring many of those parts of the other parts of the world, people who speak English from those parts of the world, here onto the radio to talk about those parts of the world. I mean, for example, with Somalia, we've got a massive Somali population, but actually, many people don't know where Somalia is. And of course, it's quite nice to have Somalis telling us a little bit about the history of their country. Many of these countries, of course, were dominated by the English, by the British Empire in the past. And yet they still have a trust and an acceptance of the British way of life. And they see something positive rather than just hating the British as a sort of former colonial power. So here in Bristol, are there areas which are worse than others? Some are better?
Yes, there are. They said the most reported crimes tend to be in Bristol city centre. St Paul's had 124, Southfield 148 incidents reported, Fillwood 201, but the highest recorded race crime incidents were in the Trinity Ward, which is Lawrence Hill and Easton.
One of the things that bothers me about a lot of this is the amazing amount of press coverage that certain groups seem to get, like the English Defence League. People like Tommy Robinson as the spokesperson has got a lot of coverage. So where do you think the impetus comes from for the press to give a lot more coverage to the far right and the right wing, that is the people who are being rather xenophobic, and maybe less to ordinary community groups? I mean, we've got an amazing situation now in Bristol where the head of the Sikh temple in Bristol, who's been here for 10 years, has been threatened by the Home Office that he's got to leave Bristol without giving him any reason, and yet that's hardly been reported by the press. Some of the stories the press seem to pick up on, and others they don't.
I think it also depends on the press. As John Danzig said earlier about the Daily Mail, perhaps have a different agenda and they report with a different angle. There was an article in The Mirror, however, only earlier this month, which took a more sympathetic view. Also said, rather than referring to the migrant crisis, we should refer to it as a humanitarian crisis in Calais, and also gave various figures in support, you know, of the fact that it isn't such a threat as it's been perceived, perhaps in other publications. Also, it pointed out that Brunel is a migrant, and so we have a lot to be grateful for to migrants.
Angela Balassi, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, Sabine McNeil, talking about CERN, where she worked for many years, and also Peter Oakes, a victim of RBS, as well as John Danzig, the journalist, and Angela Balassi. Also to studio engineer Dave Bozanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. Get hold of us through Volunteering Bristol, bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
What did we see when we got there? Prison bars, prison bars. What did we see when we got there? Prison bars and more. What did we see when we got there? Cold, dark dungeons, damp and bare. Prison bars, prison bars, prison bars and more. Well, what was it like down in that cell? Prison bars, prison bars. What was it like down in that cell? Prison bars and more. What was it like down in that cell? It was worse than the deepest parts of hell. Prison bars, prison bars, prison bars and more. Rancid soup and moldy meat. Prison bars, prison bars. Rancid soup and moldy meat. Prison bars and more. Rancid soup and moldy meat. That's what they gave us there to eat. Prison bars, prison bars, prison bars and more. And what was worse than moldy meat? Prison bars, prison bars. What was worse than moldy meat? Prison bars and more. What was worse than moldy meat? Fires that gave out smoke, not heat. Prison bars, prison bars, prison bars and more. And what was worse than all of this? Prison bars, prison bars. What was worse than all of this? Prison bars and more. What was worse than all of this? A lack of freedom, no justice. Prison bars, prison bars, prison bars and more.
Oh, three little pigs, they left their sty, and they bade their mother a fond goodbye, and each his fortune he did try to prove them pigs of metal. Well, one went east and one went west, one by the road that he thought the best, and each in property did invest, on which he hoped to settle. The first little pig built a nest of hay, he didn't have any foundations to lay, and the big bad wolf, he came that way, called on him to surrender. Oh, little pig, let me come in. Oh, no, by the hairs on my chinny chin chin, while I'll huff and I'll puff and I'll blow your house in. Oh, wasn't he sweet and tender? The next little pig built a timber shack, it would keep the weather from off of his back. He hoped to be safe from any attack, but the wolf, he thought, how easy. Oh, little pig, let me come in. Oh, no, by the hairs on my chinny chin chin, I'll puff and I'll blow your house in. Oh, wasn't he rich and greasy? The third little pig built a house of brick, and the walls were 18 inches thick. He thinks to himself, this'll do the trick, and the wolf can do his worst. Oh, little pig, let me come in. Oh, no, by the hairs on my chinny chin chin, well, I'll huff and I'll puff and I'll blow your house in. He blew till he well nigh burst. He huffed and he puffed like a turbo jet. If he'd not got his breath, he'd be puffing there yet. He thinks to himself, some trap I must set, if this little pig's to be taken. Oh, little pig, won't you come out? For apples and turnips lie round about. The little pig laughed at him up his snout, 'cause he always saved his bacon. The wolf completely lost control and tried to get in down the chimney hole. He fell right into the casserole. Oh, how the pot did bubble! The little pig brandished his knife and fork, 'cause pigs like wolf more than wolf likes pork. And many a bottle did lose its cork in toasting the end of his troubles. Well, when he had finished with his carouse, he courted the very fleetest of sows, and he took her back home to his fine brick house to live in honour and glory. Well, five little pigs in time did come, one went to market, one stayed home. One had roast beef and the other had none, but that's another story. I got the blues from my baby sitting down by the Frisco Bay. Big ocean liner gone, took her away. Didn't mean to treat her bad, she was the best friend I ever have had. She said goodbye, she made me cry, she made me want to lay down my head and die. Ain't got a nickel and I ain't got a lousy dime. Don't come back, baby, gonna lose my mind. She ever come back to stay, well, that'll be another brand new day. Walking with my baby down beside the San Francisco Bay. I'm sitting down on my back porch, I'm wondering which way to turn. The girl that I'm so crazy about, she don't love me anymore. I think I'm gonna take a freight train, 'cause I'm feeling blue, and I'm gonna ride to the end of the line, thinking only of you. Well, I ain't got a nickel and I ain't got a lousy dime. She don't come back, well, baby, gonna lose my mind. She ever come back to stay, well, that'll be another brand new day. Walking with my baby down beside the San Francisco Bay. Well, meantime, in another city, just about to go insane. Girl that I'm so crazy about, she doesn't call my name. She ever come back to stay, well, that'll be another brand new day. Walking with my baby down beside the San Francisco Bay.